welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema with me, your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XXFM on the 98.3 frequency. This week's topic is Descendants and Ancestors. We're talking Descendants and Ancestors this week. Films that look at the link between the people of the past, those that are dead, and us that are currently living, currently breathing, eating, and loving each other, or maybe hating. These are all concepts that will come up in today's episode. I've sort of been interested in this topic for quite a while now, I suppose, because it does sort of seem to me that at this point in history, you know, in the last couple of years, maybe the last 5-10 years or so, we have looked back at the past with a great deal of contempt, or dare I say negativity, just in a general sense. Maybe a bit of resentment. We look back and consider the people of the past very ignorant, very evil, that they set us up for failure in a way, that we have these vestiges of the past that continue to permeate through society and have got people off onto the wrong foot and created sort of these, not necessarily ancient hatreds or anything like that, but have put certain people in certain buckets and have left certain people in, you know, certain people advantaged and certain people disadvantaged, and that we often look back at cultures and societies and systems with old vestiges, with long ties, with ties that go back in history, as things that are inevitably negative. Now, this isn't all people, of course. I just feel like this is quite a mainstream view amongst a lot of people. And then also, I guess the other side of things is that anything that seems new and refreshing and different is definitely a good thing. And I suppose this is ultimately the question of, you know, does progressivism beat out conservatism? And that's sort of that eternal question that really can never be answered in any way other than, well, it depends, and it's all circumstantial, and some things you want to keep and some things you want to dispose of and that sort of thing. But I want to speak about mostly this week about films that are talking about specific people, and they can be symbolic of the past, but in particular, but sort of our own familial ties to the past, and seeing these as personifications of that that attention toward how we deal with the past, in the way that, you know, the characters in these films, the way that they deal with their ancestors as descendants of their ancestors, you know, how they deal with them and the positions that they've been put in by those people. That being indicative or representative of how we deal with where the past itself as a concept has put us in the present moment. And I guess, you know, before we get started, I think there's some broader questions that we can sort of check off before we even get stuck into the movies themselves. I mean, in answering that question of where that comes from, that sense of contempt or resentment for the past, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, right? I mean, like, it's not hard to see the vestiges of something like colonialism, for example, continuing to put people, certain people in certain groups, off on the wrong foot in life, or giving them, being something that necessarily creates certain systemic disadvantages and that sort of thing. And even just broader than that, I mean, there's been so many terrible things that, you know, the 2020 clarity of hindsight gives us, that you know, when we look back at things like certain political views, certain political institutions and parties and entities and things like that, how they brought about war, or certain economic, if you look at something like World War II, for example, and the lead up to that, we can look back and say, you know, that didn't work. You know, fascism wasn't something that we want to repeat again. There's no shortage of evidence in the past to look at, be it, you know, violence or war or destruction or anything, and say, well, you know, the past is riddled with that sort of thing. And naturally, we do evolve morally, but also, you know, in terms of industry and technology and things like that, we do evolve every year. So looking back is always going to be something that has a great deal of negativity associated with it. But I do want to look at the limits of that as well. I don't just want to sit and wallow in how bad the past was. I want to talk about, is there anything that we can pull from the past that is still useful to us, or something that we should revisit or anything like that? And in the three films we're going to talk about, I think all of them are pretty clear in showing that there are things from the past that we should be leaving in the past. I don't mean to say that that's all we're doing this week, but I want to see, where does that seesaw, how can we get some balance on that seesaw? How do we determine the things that we leave in the past, and how do we determine the things that we want to continue, we want to consolidate on, or bring in into the present or take into the future sort of thing. But, you know, as always, we've got a fair bit to get through, I think, this week. We're talking about some three films that I really, really enjoy. I mean, I kind of enjoy all the films that we talk about on this show, but these three in particular, you know, rewatching them this week, I really enjoyed going back to them, picking up new things from them, and you know, I think all three, they're very different films, but all are getting at this idea of descendants and ancestors and things like that. The first one we're going to talk about is Hereditary, the Ari Aster film from 2018, and of course we're going to talk about this one because we talked about Midsommar a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to revisit this one from Aster just because you know, in my third rewatch of Midsommar, I picked up on stuff that I hadn't picked up the first couple times, and then so I really want to go back to Hereditary and see there's some stuff that I could still get from that. And there absolutely is lots of things that you can get from that film going back. But then I'm going to move on from there to a New Zealand film directed by Lee Tamahori. And that is, of course, the 1994. Well, I guess if you're an Australian or New Zealand film fan, you definitely know all about this. This film, this is Once We're Warriors. Any of our international listeners might not be familiar with this film, but it's an absolute belter. So feel free to check that one out. I'm not sure if it's on any of the American or British or European or other, you know, streaming services around the world, but yeah, I think this one is available. I think it was on Netflix I saw this one. So you can still go back and watch this one, even though it was a bit of a one from the past. And then we're going to finish off with a film by a director who I consider be really like definitely a top 10 director in my books. And that would be Alexander Payne's 2011 film, The Descendants, starring George Clooney. I'm a huge Alexander Payne fan. I can't believe we've never talked about any of his films on the show. I can't believe we've gone this whole time without talking about Nebraska, for example. I love that movie so much. But let's get started now with Ari Aster's 2018. I guess you'd call it a horror, but I don't think he wanted a class that way. Let's just call it a very dark drama, and that is Hereditary. So I want to look at this one in trying to answer the question of what sort of accounts for our skepticism of the past. Well, not necessarily our skepticism, but our sense of distrust in the past, or our sense of contempt for the past, and sort of, you know, what the past brings, and some of the curses or the horrors that we inherit from the past. So if you haven't seen this one, I mean, it starts off, or at least the first sort of action shot is this: it's about a family, and it's a mum and a dad and an older brother and a younger sister, and the older brother wakes up and his father comes into his room and says, you've got to get ready for the funeral. And the whole film sort of springboards out of this funeral that's taking place because of the grandma, and the family has just passed away, and we find out that she was a bit of a private, bit of a kooky grandma, and she didn't really get along with the mother of the family, Toni Collette, who's sort of like the main character in this film, I suppose. They're all pretty important. That's really that's an interesting statement to make. Who actually is the main character in this film? Because it sort of slips and slides around sort of the point of, you know, who's in the point of focus at different points. But the whole film sort of springboards from this funeral and the family coming to terms with, you know, the death of this very private lady who was a little bit controversial in terms of who she favoured. And obviously Toni Collette, who was her daughter and who's the mother of this family, didn't really get on with her that well. And when she goes to her grieving seminar or whatever, we sort of find out that her family has some pretty dark, you know, mental illness, tragedies there. There was some pretty crazy stuff that went on there. And then as the film progresses, I mean, for people that haven't seen the film yet, I don't want to give away some of the massive spoilers if you haven't seen it. But as the film progresses, there's more and more tragedies that take place. One very big one in particular, and sort of the, let's put it, the cohesion or the integrity of this family very quickly unravels. And if anything, you know, this is a film that really, I mean, like, I have no confidence in how I've interpreted this film. Like, in terms of interpreting a film, this is one of the hardest ones to, I would say, walk away feeling clarity about what Mr. Aster was trying to tell us in this one. But I almost love it for that reason. I find films like that actually even more enjoyable, to be honest. And like, I feel quite strongly about the way that I've read this film, but I think if anything you can take from this film, you can get out of this film some seriously familiar scenes in terms of the interactions between particularly Toni Collette's character and her son's character. There's a particular dinner table scene which is a perfect articulation of how a conversation would go between two family members who usually wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't really spill this stuff out because part of being in a family is loving each other and not telling people sort of how you feel sometimes, but also you know, a perfect example of how you feel. Like the writing in that particular scene is just just bang on, and the performances. Toni Collette, I don't mean it's just as an Aussie, but she is a phenomenal actor. She does have that chameleon ability to sort of go into a horror film, having not been a horror star, and just perfectly nail a horror part. Or she can be in About a Boy, or she can be in, I almost called it a Big Yellow Taxi, Big Yellow Bus, A Little Miss Sunshine, and nail that. I mean, she's always sort of playing like a maternal, mother part in a way in a lot of films, but I mean she does it all. She's definitely the best part of this film. But I suppose to start off our conversation about this film, this can be a film for you that just reminds you of some of those doubts you have about people in your family and how they really feel, and what families would actually look like if things unravel and there was enough tragedies to bring out the darker truths, right? The darker moments of honesty that are very often suppressed in the family. But as the film carries on, all of these concepts of anger and contempt and resentment, and then you get things like grief and guilt, and the portrayal of cowardice in this film is you could spend the whole movie, you could go back and rewatch this movie just through the lens of any of those different aspects of human behavior, be it grief or guilt or any of those things. But particularly cowardice, particularly in the father character, his apathy, or not his apathy, but his disinterest in engaging in those more hardcore family moments. He does have that henpecked husband kind of, I don't really want to get anyone angry, I don't really want to do that. His performance is fantastic, and so his character is fantastic. So all of these different sort of negative behavioral traits come out, and as that sort of blossoms, it's revealed that the grandma at the helm of this family, who was without using a party, was sort of at the head of all of this. Let's just put it this way. She's part of a cult, one of these occult satanic... What's the difference between a cult and occult? I don't know. But one of these, satanic groups. And it turns out that... Let's just put it this way. The family is pretty much cursed by something that her and her weirdo posse, not to offend any Satanists out there, but her weird group... she sort of condemned their family to this very demonic situation. So, there's a lot of ways you can view this film. You can just say it's a classic horror film, which is what would happen if, a family was cursed, But I, the way I like to view this film is that it sort of portrays historic interpersonal ties. So it portrays, I guess, familial connections or lineage, let's say that. But I don't want to just limit it to the familial. Let's just say human lineage, the lineage that exists between those of the past and those in the present. It conveys those kinds of ties as a curse. In other words, it pretty much imagines, or we can view it in a way that it is imagining the vestiges of our past as if we were cursed by the past. So the vestiges of our past are like a curse. The things that hold us back in life, the things that create complexes, and the things that we have anxieties about that we may have inherited from the past, as if we're being cursed by some kind of supernatural entity. So it's a bit of an imaginative leap, but it is kind of the perfect metaphor when we start to unpack it a little bit like that. And one of the aspects of a curse that I think that what makes that metaphor work is that a curse is sort of saying that you can't really do much about it. You're sort of hopeless in the face of a curse. There's this sense of this lack of free will, this sense of determinism, there's inevitability. It's a bit like a prophecy, that sort of thing. And we even get this little discussion in the classroom, in one of the scenes in the boys' classroom, about is a film or is a story more tragic when the characters could have done something about it, or if they couldn't, and the idea of hopelessness, and if they never had any hope, that's kind of makes things even sadder. But when you do have hope to change your situation and you can't, that makes it all the more tragic and that sort of thing. So sort of dealing with this idea of being inevitably cursed by your grandmother or by your past is something that is sort of quite horrible, and it makes us feel very sorry for the people that have to deal with it. But I want to speak about the actual mechanics of the specific curse that this family is affected by. And the long and short of it, and this is going to give away a bit of a spoiler, but I'll try and speak about it in a way that it doesn't. The boy is, he's sort of predestined to be this guy, King Paimon, who you know, and there's an actual excerpt from the film which describes who he is, Paimon, being one of the eight kings of hell. And, you know, these people, they look to the northwest to call him, and they've corrected the first female bodied now to give King Paimon this healthy male host. They reject the Trinity and they pray devoutly to this King Paimon, and they ask that he gives them his knowledge of all secret things, brings them honor, wealth, and good familiars, bind all men to our will as we have bound ourselves for now and ever to yours. So he's not a great guy, this King Paimon guy. In fact, there is even a way to read this character as if he's sort of the archetypal evil character, sort of the most archetypally evil character of the 21st century. Even down to the point that the fact that, like, he has a female face but a male body, it's almost like he's co-opting femininity for his own sinister objectives. And if we look at something like the current phenomenon of these sort of sensitive new age nice guys that manipulate women, you know, they have the head of a woman, they have the face of a woman in a way, but they're still acting in a way that has a sort of a more toxic masculine quality to it. I don't want to read into it too much, but I guess that what this is sort of lifting up, it's sort of saying that the evils of our current world, they manifest from the curses of the past. These horrific archetypes reappear through the form of curses, through the vestiges of the past. These horrible archetypes reappear. So that doesn't really leave us with a very positive idea, a very positive outlook of the past. It makes us sort of feel like, these inevitable reappearances of these bad guys, we're kind of doomed. Is there anything from the past that we can take that is good? And at this point, I think it's worth moving on to our second film of today's discussion, and that would be Lee at Samahora's 1994 film, Once We're Warriors. But before we proceed, I just want to remind you, you are listening to 2XXFM. You're listening to Sacred Cinema with me, your host, Jimmy Berners. Keep listening here on 2XXM, 2XXFM for more great radio content here on the station. But if you're listening online, feel free to sponsor the show or any of other any of your other favorite 2XX shows while you're on the website, or consider subscribing to the station while you're there also. But let's move on now to our next film for today's discussion around descendants and ancestors. And we're going to talk now about Once We're Warriors. It's a New Zealand film, and really, I think you can get the whole. Almost like you can get the whole vibe of this film just from the opening shot, and also in combination sort of with what the title conveys. But we get this opening shot of this beautiful, lush New Zealand landscape, something you'd see from like an Air New Zealand ad or like a New Zealand natural ice cream box. It's this beautiful sort of like rolling hills and a beautiful lake. And then we move out. We zoom out and we realize this is actually a billboard amongst this very sort of industrious. And I mean, this film is 1994. It kind of has a bit of that like Road Warrior, lots of leather, a lot of that kind of Mad Maxy kind of water world, you know, that everyone's wearing like those leather, like sleeveless leather, you know, like people have got like almost as if they've got like a bullet chain things across their like vests. It's very industrial, and there's lots of machines and steam, and it's kind of a bit cyberpunky and that sort of thing going on. And so we have this, you know, obviously this obvious metaphor of sort of this is what our impression of New Zealand is, but this is actually what it is. And the idea of, you know, once were warriors, there was a time in this past, this romanticized time in the past of what New Zealand was traditionally, and now it's become this corrupted postmodern capitalist garbage dump. And I suppose, you know, the merging from the landscape to the billboard to industry sort of conveys the film from the outset being about sort of living with or at least not necessarily living with, but maybe coming to terms with, or even weaponizing or utilizing. So I guess there's different ways of thinking about it. You know, there's a positive or a negative lens to look at the past. You know, how do we, you know, coming to terms with it is sort of a negative thing. You know, that we have these vestiges that we don't really appreciate, that aren't really helpful. Or do we want to think about how we can utilize them? Or you know, a more extreme version of utilizing is weaponizing in a way, which is, you know, maybe a more negative, more combative way. You know, how can we use this image that we have of the past for, you know, and that still lingers, the image still lingers, our connection to the past still lingers, how can we use that to our benefit? And if we combine it with sort of the title of the film, Once Were Warriors, right? Obviously, you got the Maori culture in New Zealand and the larger Pacific Islander culture there. When we think about what is a warrior, right? You know, on one hand, a warrior, you think about warrior, you think, you know, war, warrior, war, warmongering, fighting, violence, blood, guts, that sort of thing. And that's definitely this motif throughout the film. And when we think about, you know, Once Were Warriors, is you can almost make the argument that there's this vestige of this combative and violent culture, and we see a lot of sort of domestic violence and things like that going on in the film, but that is way too simplistic a view of what the film actually is about, because, you know, when we also think about warrior, we think about bravery, we think about courage, and we think about being valiant, and we see that also coming playing out in the film, where the kid in this film, just a quick plot synopsis, by the way, if you haven't seen the film. Basically, it's about this family that live in a pretty impoverished situation. The husband and wife have an extremely... this is a very, very violent film. And then one of the children goes off to essentially like juvie, that sort of thing. And then, you know, the rest of the family is essentially living out this life in poverty and dealing with alcoholism and domestic violence and that sort of thing. So, you know, that sort of violent element of being a warrior definitely shows itself in the domestic violence and that sort of thing we see in this film. But also there's this really beautiful storyline that takes place with Boogie, the one of the boys in this family, who goes off to this juvenile like military school type place, and you know they teach him how to do a haka and how to, you know, and we see that in real life, you know, the way that's, you know, New Zealand schoolboys and things like that use the haka as a means to you know, you see those funeral videos on YouTube, and you know it's a means of camaraderie and solidarity and manhood and actually growing up and being strong in a good way. So when we deal with, you know, our past as warriors, you know, our warrior past, it does have this sort of dualistic quality to it, where there's good things and there are bad things that come from it. And we sort of view the present as the natural or the precise or the perfect resolution of, or the perfect evolution of, all of those things culminating, the good things, the bad things about our, not just our warrior past, but our past in all senses, that the present is just the natural evolution of all those things from our past, both good, both bad. And we have to come to terms with the fact that we are constantly swarmed by both bad and good things from the past, which leaves us with this dilemma, which is, how do we extract the good from the past but reject the bad? Is there some way we can do that? And at this point, I'd like to move on to our third and final film, which is Alexander Payne's 2011 film, The Descendants, starring... this one's about George Clooney is our main character in this film. And I guess the general premise of this one is that he's coming to the terms with the fact that his wife is on her deathbed. She's been in this boating accident, and he's coming to terms with moving on. And, you know, he's a very busy man. He's a lawyer and that sort of thing. And he's coming to terms with the fact that, what is he going to do now she's gone? How's he going to take care of his two girls, who he doesn't really know how to deal with them. They're girls, he's a boy, there's a whole thing there, what he thinks. To make matters more complicated, we find out very early on in the film that she actually cheated on him. So it's not just a story of, you know, how is Mr. Mum going to figure it out? It's like, how does a man move on from the fact that the woman that he's been married to this whole time, that he's supposed to be grieving over and feeling sad about, actually betrayed him? And this is sort of the inverse of what we talked about when we talked about the weeping widow. And this is sort of why I went back and watched this film, because this is sort of the male version of those films I talk about. You know, moving on from the death of someone who probably wasn't the right person, and we get into this weird situation where we do want to feel sorry for them, but at the same time, we're like, actually, I'm kind of glad they're gone. Maybe is that bad? Should I feel that? You know, that we've sort of meditated on that for a bit before. But simultaneous to that whole plot line, he's also a trustee of this massive patch of Hawaiian land. And obviously, you know, it being Hawaiian, there's this the whole question of, like, is it colonialism in the American context? I suppose it is, right? Where him as a white guy has, and his family now have ownership over this land that they got through a series of familial, you know, inter-familial marriages. It's meant to be convoluted and complicated, but essentially they have ownership to this land that was originally native Hawaiian land, and they have to sell it. They're coming to terms with having to sell it, and which big corporation should they sell to? What's the most ethical thing to do in this situation? And I like to think that the selling of that land is sort of a metaphor for how George Clooney is supposed to move on in his own life, given this sort of situation. And I think that the best way to think about this film, or the way that I like to think about this film, is to lift up this idea that we can take things from the past that make our lives better, but that does sort of mean taking on both the burdens and the benefits of our past. If we can accept our past as part of who we are, that's sort of the way that we're able to find a way to use the good parts of it, to find the benefits of the vestiges, the good vestiges of our past, and be able to use them to our own benefit. And I think that's actually best summarized sort of in the final act of this film when George, again, I don't want to give away any spoils here, but when George Clooney sort of has to fess up and come to terms with how he really feels and what the best foot forward is to take, he sort of has to think about his marriage as something that was more than just a relationship built on betrayal. And we don't really get much, there's some voicing in the film about how he treated her as a husband or whether, you know, the extent to which he was there for her, the extent to which he provided himself as a romantic counterpart for her, and we meet the other man and all that sort of thing, and we do sort of have that in the back of our heads, like this sort of lazy Joe guy with his Hawaiian shirt on and everything. And he doesn't really do anything too terrible in the film. We do kind of feel he's a little bit lackluster as a guy, and you know, is it really fair to her to think of her to be this completely two-dimensionally bad person, right? Do we have to sort of maybe sympathize with her, take the high road, and think that maybe that he could have done more or something like that? Are there things that he can look at that become nutritious for the sake of his growth as a person? Is there a way that he can reflect on that marriage in a way that isn't completely nihilistic and negative? And I think that the way that this film ends, the final shot of this film, I won't give it away if you haven't seen it, but perfectly depicts what matters most in life, and the fact that there is a direct relationship between, you know, the marriage that he had and the connection that he had with his wife and what he now has now that she's gone, or now that she's about to go. And is that actually a net benefit despite everything, or the betrayal and everything like that? That is to say that, you know, the journey that he undertakes in finding himself and figuring all this stuff out involves getting in touch with his daughters and learning a lot more about who they are. And of course, they come from him and her, right? He wouldn't have them if it wasn't for her, and he wouldn't be able to grow as a person if it wasn't for them. They sort of teach him, not necessarily how to become a better adult. It's not like that situation where, you know, the daughter becomes the new mother, that sort of thing, but he does sort of learn about what he loves and what he values and what's important and what makes him feel at peace and more of a stable person. So I suppose to tie everything together this week, I guess it's pretty fair to look back in the past and feel this sense of contempt and feel that we've been, without signing up to it, our ancestors have sort of put us on this path, this path of inevitability, that sort of means that we're going to necessarily have to engage in some sort of evil activity and that sort of thing. But when we talk about Once Were Warriors, I suppose we lifted up this idea that if we have such a limited view of the past, if we only look at it through that negative lens, we fail to sort of split apart the good and the bad from it and find and pull out all the positive things that can help us be more brave, that can help us be more valiant and make us be a bit more courageous. And so I suppose in The Descendants, we got into this conversation about, how should we view it then? How should we view the past? And if we fully embrace it and understand what the positive things that have come from that, we start to realize that, you know, having such a narrow view of the past is something that holds us back. And maybe we need to view ourselves and the people around us as these valuable children, the descendants of the past, something that's sacred that comes from the past. We've been handed something important rather than the cursed vestiges of our ancestors. Well, that's it for Sacred Cinema this week. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XXFM on the 98.3 wavelength. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XXFM, or if you're listening on our website, please consider subscribing to the station while you're there, or sponsoring the show, or any of your other favorite 2XX shows. But until next time, please keep getting in contact with me on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, that sort of thing. We'll see you again very soon. Cheers.